Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the health care they need. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. Today on our show, we talked to two Fresno Unified School Board members about the vote this week to censure one of them. I'm Laura Satsui.
And I'm Alice Daniel. Wednesday was National Healthcare for the Homeless Day. We hear from one woman about the challenges of taking care of yourself when you don't even have a place to store food or medications.
But first, let's turn to this week's news. On Monday, the Delano City Council voted 4-1 to become the Valley's second sanctuary city. Livingston was the first.
We're here simply to determine whether a resolution can have a psychological effect on the community, specifically the immigrant community. And I think they can.
That's Councilmember Joe Alinda Howe. The one dissenting vote came from Delano Mayor Joe Aguirre, who referred to a recent federal appeals court ruling that upholds the Trump administration's decision to give more funding to cities that work with ICE.
We're going to take away federal funding from law enforcement. It's not going to affect anything else but law enforcement.
But the city's police chief says this won't affect the department, since it already follows a state law limiting their involvement with ICE.
Tulare Congressman Devin Nunes filed yet another lawsuit last week, aimed at constituents who argued his title of farmer on the 2018 November ballot was inaccurate. Phil Arbayo, the Democratic candidate vying for Nunes's seat, announced Tuesday he would help raise a legal defense fund for those Nunes is suing. He also directed a comment at Nunes.
If you're going to sue anyone, sue me.
On Tuesday, California Attorney General Javier Becerra was in Fresno to award the California Department of Special Operations Unit for its role in dismantling MS-13 gang operations. U.S. Attorney McGregor Scott says about two dozen MS-13 members and associates were charged at the Fresno Federal Courthouse. By gathering information through wiretaps, multiple local and state agencies linked MS-13 to murders around the nation and Valley.
We've given Mendota its life back. People can now walk the streets again. People can now go to the parks again. People can now send their children to go to school without fear from this MS-13 organization.
Next week, voters in Northwest Fresno will choose a new city council member from five men seeking to succeed Steve Brandow. District 2 has been without a representative since Brandow left the council to join the Fresno County Board of Supervisors.
And finally, the Fresno Unified School District Board voted 6-0 this week to censure board member Terry Sladek for unethical conduct. The censure means Sladek can't attend internal staff meetings, and he must notify school administrators before visiting district campuses. He'll also need an escort. And before he takes on leadership roles as a trustee, he has to take an anger management course. For more on this, moderator Kathleen Schock spoke with Sladek and board member Veva Islas.
So, Trustee Sladek, let's start with you. What is your response to the vote on Wednesday?
It's nothing that I did not expect. I understood from the paperwork that was issued prior how everyone felt, and I knew it was a fait accompli going in. So there's no shock or awe to me.
And will you be taking legal actions?
Yes.
What are the next steps for you?
Well, if you understand the word censure in what's called black letter law, that's a term that means something legal. You can't morph it. Okay, and it means you get to tell me that I'm ugly and my mother dresses me funny, or in this case, you don't like what I did. It doesn't mean you get to take stuff away. That is not what censure means, because that means censure in the case of an elected official, you are then disenfranchising their voters. And by saying you can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do this, voters get disenfranchised, and the courts have made a lot of pretty good rulings on those things.
So, and just so our listeners are aware, the censure has barred you from participating in internal staff meetings, asking that you notify administration when you plan to visit a campus, and that you sign in as a visitor and are escorted when you arrive. Is your intention to comply with those mandates?
I'll let you know when my legal team decides the path forward.
Very good. Trustee Islas, you voted in favor of the censure.
Absolutely.
And have been pretty vocal in your calls for Trustee Sladek to step down. What is your position on this?
Well, you know, the trustee may not be in shock about the censure, but we're still in shock about his actions. You know, I've been disgruntled since January when I learned about his assault on a student. You know, last night I was really emotional and I was really emotional because there is so much to the history of that student that is about trauma in his life. And here we have an elected official who really could have engaged in a much different way with that child that would not have furthered trauma to him. So I absolutely believe that the censure is the right thing. And I'm only sorry that we can't do more.
Well, that was my follow-up question. You know, there have been calls for many parents to take additional steps. Why have you stayed with why the censure at this point? Or are there talks about going further?
Well, there really isn't any more recourse as a board that we can take. I think that the items that we put in the censure, you know, are aggressive, but they're aggressive in response to aggressive things that he has done. So, you know, he can try to argue the semantics about censure, but everything that is in our resolution has precedent. There are other districts that have done that, everything that we've put in there and more. So I think he's going to have a hard row to hoe in order to establish that what we're doing is against the law.
So, Trustee Sladek, explain to me in your mind how a protracted, likely legal battle is in the best interest of the students of Fresno Unified.
Oh, I don't think it is. But before we address that, let's address Trustee Islas' loose use of language. If I had assaulted someone in January, the district attorney would have said that I assaulted someone. District attorney didn't say that I assaulted someone. So again, these words mean things. And again, they mean legal things. You don't get to reinterpret legal terms the way you want to make a point. Well, in politics you do, but you will be called out on it in this case. So if the district attorney doesn't say that I assaulted someone, I didn't assault someone. It's that simple.
The district attorney did not do any investigation.
But the use of the word assault aside, there were several incidents for which you have reached this point in your public service. Again, I mean, in what way do you please explain why you felt your actions were in the best interest of students?
It's this simple to me, is we have a failing school district. No one wants to talk about that. So I'm out there 40, 50 hours a week asking questions. The typical trustee is out there much less than that. Okay. And I'm out there asking these questions, all these people. It took me with full access to all the information to determine, as was pointed out at the meeting last night by a constituent, that the graduates of Fresno Unified, the average is sixth grade math and English. Why isn't anybody talking about that? So that's why there's all these wonderful things that everyone wants to talk. Oh, we made a 10.4% over the last 4 years increase on that. What is the grade level aptitude of the kids we're given diplomas to? And how many kids are below 1.99 GPA when we give them a diploma?
And nothing that's that he the has discussion. Done moves the needle on that. Absolutely nothing that he has done and everything that is in the resolution is in response to his inappropriate actions, not his at least verbal espousal of his intents to improve the district. Every trustee on this board, it would be right behind Terry if everything that he did was about moving that needle, and it's not. And he's failing to acknowledge what he has done that is inappropriate. He wants to deflect and say, oh, well, I'm this change agent. I'm drawing all this attention because I'm asking tough questions. Let me just personally say he is not the only one asking tough questions. he is not the only one asking for an improved outcome in our students' achievements. He is the only one who is grabbing students. He is the only one who is inappropriately engaging young women. He is the only one who is threatening district employees about their employment, right? There is a manner and an approach in order to change these things, and he clearly just is not wanting to follow that.
I mean, I will say, as somebody who has been watching this story unfold, it does feel like a distraction from the work of the district. You argue that it is not?
Tell me who has been in the public eye saying that we're giving diplomas to kids with sixth grade educations. Tell me, when was the last time besides me that came out of somebody's mouth in the media? Okay, please give me the example. I'm a simple man.
All right, let's talk about the finances involved. You know, the school district has to date spent more than $100,000 in response to the investigations surrounding some of your behavior in the past. Certainly, if you sue the school district, those legal fees will increase. Do you feel that's a decent use of funds?
If I didn't need to sue the school district over this document that they produced, then they wouldn't be having to spend the legal expenses that they'll have to spend on this. That's their choice.
There have been monies that have already been spent, and it's been because of investigations prompted as a result of his inappropriate actions.
And can you be specific about what actions you're referring to?
So, the issue in January, on January 11th, when he assaulted the student, there was an investigation full on about that. There was an investigation about his engagement with an Army recruiter. Again, that was inappropriate and led to a complaint by that recruiter. There was an investigation about his engagement with the coach, right? In that disagreement with the coach, he threatened the future career of that coach, and he evoked his title as trustee and having power to do that. That was extremely inappropriate. There is an investigation now into his behavior in engaging the students and the threats that he made about canceling their chair cramp, about bringing up history of previous drug use. So there's an investigation about that. And I have to tell you, I have insight that those are not the only investigations, that there are other issues that could potentially cause us to have to spend more money to investigate. And the very sad thing about these dollars that have been spent is not only is it an unnecessary expenditure of resources, those are dollars that are coming from the entire pot for the district. So it's not monies that are just set aside for Bullard. It's monies that are depleting McLean, Roosevelt, Sunnyside, Fresno High. The $114,000 could go a really long way into establishing summer learning programs to the benefit of what he claims he really wants, right? Our students advancing academically. It could go to help support enrichment for our teachers. It could go for technology that many of our substitute teachers need. There's just limitless ideas of how those monies could have been much better spent.
So, Trustee Sladek, ultimately, you are accountable to your constituents. What are you hearing from them?
My constituents are completely supporting me. You're 90% of them.
Based on what? Considering there is a recall effort underway.
I'm not aware of there's a
recall. There's a recall effort being organized, I should say.
I'm not aware of one being underway.
Okay. I thank you for the clarification.
Okay.
There are community members that are organizing in order to put a recall on the ballot. You're telling me now that you're not hearing any negative feedback from your constituents.
Not from my core group of constituents who want change. I ran for transparency and accountability. Everyone has watched over these last 10 years. My first child got to Bullard High School 10 years ago. And over this 10-year period that I've had my personal kids at Bullard, we have watched the performance and the teaching and the academics just circle the toilet. So the people who elected me and supported me want change and I simply ran on transparency and accountability. I look at it this way, Kathleen, that I vetted the campaign platforms of trustees running for the last 10 years. And everybody wanted, I want to have, increased this and decrease that and increase. But it was always virtually the exact same verbiage. And I sit there and go, well, obviously, we haven't gotten to that because people are still making the exact same campaign promises. So I was simple, transparency and accountability. So what is our grade level math and English aptitude? And it's sixth grade, guys.
Right. Trustee Islas, you've called for Trustee Sladek to step down. You have been in support of those who are talking about a recall initiative. Do you think there is any alternative moving forward outside of the removal of Trustee Sladek?
You know, I want to say this publicly, that Trustee Sladek is a good person, right? Like, I've sat down with him and had dinner. We've had conversation. He is not fit for the position because he doesn't have the skill set in order to do what he wants to do in a productive way.
And when you say skill set, what specifically do you mean?
I mean specifically, like, if you really want to see policy to advance, right, then you need to talk in terms of systems changes, that you need to be able to have a goal about the type of changes. You need to be able to articulate that. You need to be able to engage those stakeholders in meaningful conversations about how we move that forward. And it doesn't mean that you have to have a press media about, like, oh, we're failing and no one's calling attention to failing. The truth is, we know that we're failing in so many areas, that there are so many areas where our district does need to be improving, right? So let's get behind and start advocating for the changes that we know are going to work to improve that. And I think that it does take an inside and outside game. It takes both pushing from within and responding to our constituents that are pushing on the outside. I just don't think that he can do that. He's speaking to 90% of his constituents, right? If you look at the people that were in that boardroom, 90%, if not more, of the people that were there were all there to complain about him and how they did not want him in the position to be able to continue to hurt our students. I have to agree with them. It's not one incident. It's now many instances where he feels like his omnipotence and his privilege should be able to get him through all of these crazy things that any other person, in particular people of color, would not have been allowed to do.
Trustee Sladek, we have just a minute or two before we have to wrap up, and I want to give you the last word. I understand that you are defending your actions in the past, but you have to admit that they have led to a great deal of controversy and outrage. Even if it's as you say, true that your constituents are behind you, there are many members of the community that are very upset. Are you sympathetic to their point of view?
Oh, absolutely. I am totally sympathetic to their point of view, but in having to correct Trustee Islas on facts again, the people in the room last night, 90% of them were not constituents of mine. So let's
but they're still human beings, and can you appreciate why they're upset?
I absolutely appreciate, and I have said many times, and I say now, that if someone, anyone, wants to sit down and have a fact-based conversation about where we are and where we need to be, I will do that any place, any time.
Well, will you have a conversation about your past actions?
I'll have a fact-based
here's a
conversation.
Fact.
I'm sorry,
we're
ma'am. This is actually my time.
Okay. We're not
if
just
you don't
elected
mind.
To independently represent
this is my time, Trustee. Thank you so
thank
much.
You. No, thank you, no.
Thank you
no,
so much.
No,
okay.
Thank no.
You. I'm going to have to interrupt. Just please, thank you both for being with us today. We really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Alice Daniel. We've just heard from Fresno Unified Trustees Terry Sladek and Veva Islas about the board's motion to censure Sladek. But there's also a group of concerned citizens and parents who want Sladek to be recalled from the board, in part because students say he threatened to kick kids off the cheer team at Bullard High School if they brought up a blackface incident again, one that involved two cheerleaders who were allowed to stay on the team. I spoke with Stacy Williams, who is leading the recall effort. Stacy, you're known in Fresno as a community organizer. Tell me how you got involved in leading the recall.
Some local parents and students actually reached out to me with a previous incident that happened and had noticed the district wasn't taking the correct action on a previous incident, the blackface incident that happened in Fresno. So
with Sladek.
With Sladek, yes. And so he has continued that and when he approached the cheerleaders and got involved in yelling and threatening them, that's when people came to me and said, "We need your help."
And so how does a recall process work?
People think it's simple. Why haven't you filled out paperwork? Don't you just go down and say you want to recall someone? You actually need to get momentum. You need to get a community involved. You need to get a committee. You need to have some conversations about money and a debt. How much is this going to cost? There has to be a legal team because we have to file a letter of intention. He has to be served that letter of intention. We have to have 10 proponents from the district that are willing to have their name and address published in the Fresno Bee, which in this situation is very scary for people because they're afraid of retaliation. So after that, he has to be served the notice of intention with to 10 proponents, and then we can file with Brandy Orth's office.
And do you have to have signatures too?
Mm-hmm. So the first 10 proponents' signatures are the initial just to get it started, right? And then after that, once we get it started and everything's done, we're going to need about 10,000 signatures from the Bullard region to recall him.
10,000.
10,000.
These proponents are parents typically?
Yes, typically concerned citizens. Some parents have actually backed out recently because they're in fear for their children and retaliation from the district and retaliation from SLADC. So now we're trying to get people that maybe don't have children in the district to protect them.
And where in the process are you?
So right now, our legal team is looking over the letter of intention. It has to be 200 words or less. And so I have a team of lawyers that are going over that. We wanted to add some censure language, so we wanted to wait. We had a draft. So today and tomorrow, they will finish up that intention letter. We do have our 10 proponents with the signatures ready. So we're looking at, we're able to serve him probably next week.
Now, I'm sure many people have this question. Can the board lead a recall effort?
They cannot.
So that's why it's up to the public.
It has to be his voters. So it has to be the people that elected him. So state and local laws say that whoever elected him needs to recall him.
And I know that you're not in SLADC's district, but he said in an interview that his core group of constituents support him. Have you heard anything that contradicts this?
So far, we have not heard any support. This actually seems to be bipartisan. It seems to be Republican, Democrat, rich, poor, black, white. Everybody seems to be appalled by his behavior and saying that this is not a safe way to act. We had on a Sunday Morning Matters show where the women Republican leader, she came on and denounced his activity. So I think there's a lot of conservative people as well. And he only got about 3,000 votes in that district. That's not that many. So even if those 3,000 people agree with him, do they still agree with him now is the difference? And from what we're seeing in the community, there's an overwhelming no.
And has a trustee ever been recalled before that you know of?
It's been 30 years.
30 years since
in Fresno.
Trustee was recalled.
Mm-hmm.
And do you know why?
I don't know. I haven't investigated that yet. And then I think it's been at least over 20 years since someone has been censured as well. So we're doing some groundbreaking community work in Fresno right now.
So you're not in SLADC's district. So why be involved in a recall?
Yeah, I've asked myself that same question. When the community needs a voice, when people's children and family are in danger, they look for someone to lead. And so at this point, like I've told SLADC, pick on someone your own size. At this point, I've taken up that charge. All these children don't deserve this. It's really a community safety issue. And so I have asked if anybody else wants to volunteer to take on this recall effort. And so far, there's no volunteer.
And quickly, how much does a recall effort typically cost? What do you have to prepare for?
It's going to be at least $100,000. And that's without the candidate that you want to replace them. That's just the recall effort. So there also has to be someone that signs on to replace him. That's going to be a whole nother campaign cost. But just the recall effort in itself is probably going to be between lawyers and signatures and website and signs. I mean, it's like running a campaign. You're going to need about $100,000 minimally.
Mostly from donations?
Correct.
How long does it usually take?
We have 120 days to collect 10,000 signatures. So the recall can take about 6 months, give or take, because you have some time in the beginning, you have some time to verify in the end, and then you have 120 days to collect the signatures.
Thanks, Stacy, for coming in.
Thank you.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Alice Daniel. Homelessness is on the rise in many Valley counties, and with that comes increased concerns about addressing people's basic needs, like health care. On Wednesday, Clinica Sierra Vista marked National Healthcare for the Homeless Day with a free health fair. including vaccines, screenings, and even haircuts. I met Frances Ruth Redmond Sconyers at the event. She's 68, and she says she's been living on and off the streets for the past few years.
I did not ever dream that I would be homeless, because it's not the way I was brought up or anything. I used to be the person on the other side of the table serving you instead of you serving me. When I did become homeless, I didn't know what to do. It was like, wow, God, what do I do? And I was introduced to one of the workers here who is now a supervisor, Kyle Yang. And without her and God, I don't think I would have made it.
Well, tell me, how did you become homeless?
The person that I was with passed away unexpectedly, and he had a son-in-law that foreclosed on the house we were living at, so it just put me in the streets. Then, unfortunately, I had a relative I stayed with, and we were getting along, and then all of a sudden they just decided, hey, you're not going to give me your food stamps, you're not going to stay here.
So how long have you been on the streets?
I was on the streets maybe a couple of years. And then I'm just one of these kind of people that seem like for some reason people are drawn to me. Why, I don't know, you know. And I stayed on what's called the Hill over here. And I watched things up there that I said, you know what, I can't believe this. I mean, it was like, okay, this is not me. I manage not to do drugs, I manage not to sell my body, and I manage to survive. I had no basic street smarts, none whatsoever, because, like I said, that's not the way I was brought up.
So have you had health issues since you've been on the street?
Yes, I have. And when I was down at the Pavarella, I ended up getting pneumonia. And if it hadn't been for a nurse practitioner at the Pavarella, I probably would have died. I've had stomach problems, and I still have stomach problems. And she got me, a GI doctor.
So are you currently living somewhere?
Yeah, I stay at the Sands right now, which is the worst place in the world. But right now, you know, when you live on a fixed income, I make it. It's myself and my significant other when I want him to be. And I have my six babies with four legs, raggedy tail and a wet nose.
Can you talk to some of the health issues that homeless people have?
Okay, health issue. I consider hygiene as a health issue, you know, especially for women. We have dental problems. We have hepatitis problems. We have bacterial problems, you know. And unless we have people like myself that's willing to go out there and say, look, we have a clinic. If you have insurance or not, they will help you get your insurance. They will help you get your Medi-Cal. They will help you with food. They will help you with housing. Go down there and just say, hey, I need help. And they will welcome you in with open arms.
And how does homelessness exacerbate health conditions?
To me, we don't have places out there to shower and take care of our bodies, you know. Food issues. You know, people give out food, but we have nowhere to store it. You know, you have issues where you're living out in a field someplace. You have no bathroom facilities, you know. And I tell anybody, you know, I said, I'm going to be willing to ask city council, has any of you ever been homeless? If not, don't assume things until you're actually out there. You know, and that's the way I feel. You know, I'll challenge them. I'll challenge anybody. I'll challenge the news. I'll challenge housing. I'll challenge the council. I'll challenge the police. You know, hey, come on. Let me see you pitch a tent out there for even a weekend. I bet you they couldn't survive.
But currently you're not homeless.
Per se. Yeah, good. Yeah, but I found out they sold the place, so now we're in that, yeah. Thing is, too, is they need to have housing for people that have pets. I mean, my pets are very important to me. I mean, not only like they're like my children, okay, but the thing about it is I get depressed from time to time. And without them, for some odd reason, they'll just jump on you and start licking you and everything. And yeah, and another thing is transportation. That's very important. And thank God for our insurances and things, because CalVIVA does provide medical transportation. But what we need too is non-medical transportation. Like if we need to go to the grocery store, or I'm not talking about running over to your neighbor's house, okay, but I'm talking like grocery store, have to go pick up your medication, because they'll deliver it, but they'll charge you.
Well, that's another question I have. Medication is probably very difficult to keep track of when you're homeless.
Very much so. Yeah. So now what I'm doing is I still go to CVS, but also can get my medication through the mail. But even being homeless and trying to get medication through the mail is very hard. Yeah. And I would like to see something that they could do for the homeless that are on medication, even if they have to go to a clinic every 5 days or so, you know, to pick it up or something, or even have a van that comes out, you know, and I know it sounds weird, every day to make sure that these people that are diabetics, I'm a diabetic, you know, but I'm lucky. I control mine by diet, so I'm blessed. It's hard because if you're on insulin, what do you have to keep the insulin? Because it has to be kept cold. Even if you have a little pack, you know, how are you going to freeze the things going? So it's a big issue.
Well, thank you for talking to me today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Valley Edition. We'll be back with more stories after this.
Children are going to play.
Play?
Play.
But what about adults?
If you miss out on play, you will suffer certain consequences.
Obviously, adult play is a route for personal transformation.
It is a very necessary part of being human.
I'm Guy Raz. Press play. Next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
TED Radio Hour, tonight at 8 on Valley Public Radio.
After a week in which the last thing you want to do is talk about the news, tune into the show with the news that you want to talk about. We'll ask why you should be careful on the beaches, plus why you'll soon get where you want really quick, but with some windburn. I'm Peter Sagal. We'll be joined by the Fonz himself, Henry Winkler. Maybe he can bang on the world and make it work. Join us for the news quiz from NPR.
Listen to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Saturday at 11 on Valley Public Radio.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. Over the last 200 days of legislative session, Fresno businessman and now freshman Congressman TJ Cox has brought the House Committee on Natural Resources chair to the Valley for a water tour, co-sponsored Valley Fever legislation, and thrown his support behind a number of Democratic Party agenda items. Last weekend, he held an open house at a new district office in Selma.
Hey, thank you, everybody.
I met the congressman there to learn more about his efforts on the Hill and get his thoughts looking to 2020, since former Congressman David Valadao has announced he will run again for the seat. We start, though, by talking about who came out to the open house.
Well, I can tell you, we can sum it up with the Republican mayor that was here, who said, you know, TJ, I've seen you more in 6 months than I saw the other guy in 6 years.
That's definitely a theme of people that I've spoken to out here who kind of said that it's great there's an office here. There wasn't an office here before. And then I also want to turn to some of the legislation you have been pushing forward. You talked a little bit up there about water. You talked about helping farmers, healthcare costs, and things like that. One thing I've been covering lately is the trade war and tariffs and how that's affecting farmers. Can you talk a little bit about what you've been working on to maybe ease that burden, especially for those in the Central Valley who are growing things like almonds and, you know, stone fruit, things like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Just on two fronts. We had Raul Grijalva, the chairman of the House Natural Resources Committee, out here over Memorial Day weekend for 3 days to take a look at water infrastructure and our water infrastructure needs. And he left with a renewed sense of what we need here. He said it was eye-opening, and thank you so much. And he's got a pledge to work together with me on water infrastructure, making sure that all of our communities in our ag industry have access to clean, fresh drinking water and a resilient water supply. With regard to the trade issues, this president, I don't know if there's anybody who's ever been worse for California ag. The tariffs, which are really taxes by another word, have been devastating to us. You know, there's a walnut farmer here today who her income has been cut by 2/3. The president said, hey, today that these taxes are going to make farmers whole. The trade mitigation payments that they've been getting have been pennies on the dollar. Farmers want trade, not aid. And so we've been working on what's really called the USMCA, which is really NAFTA too. There's some particulars that need to be finalized with regard to worker protections to make sure that U.S. jobs are protected and they remain high paying with benefits, environmental protections, and certainly, you know, things that aren't related to ag, but things like bringing down the cost of prescription drugs, which are all very important. We get those things finalized and we're going to have ourselves a deal.
I'm curious, is USMCA something that you're planning on supporting?
Yes. As soon as we get those, you know, those very important worker protections, environmental protections, and some of these other things like bringing down the cost of prescription drugs. But it's so important for us because I can go out to, you know, to dairies and farms and speak to them directly, and they say, we pass this, and I can expand by, you know, by 20%, by 25%. I can hire more people. I can buy more equipment. This is such a positive. But the way it is now, it's been devastating, this trade war, particularly for California ag.
I want to also talk about water. Farmers always want more, always feel that they're not getting enough, especially because it's like the argument gets pitted as fish versus farms and things like that. What are you working on to help farmers on that front?
Yeah, well, you know, the simple thing to show them is, you know, you open up a tap and, you know, this colored water or water with an odor comes out and you pour it in a glass and say, hey, would you like to drink this? You know, this is what the people I represent are asked to do. Nobody would do that. Access to clean, fresh drinking water here in California is a human right. But we've been working on legislation to, and we're going to be introducing a pretty substantive water bill here very shortly that is going to provide more storage, above ground, below ground storage, more conveyance, really. You know, when we have water like we do this year, lots of water, it's so important to get that out to the places where it's needed so we can recharge our aquifers. And so we really need that distribution. And then the distribution systems to take the surface water and get that out to our communities because that's the best water.
I want to jump topics for a quick second. And you've also, I've noticed, co-sponsored a lot of legislation regarding immigration, you know, helping families at the border. And there is a lot of immigration in the Central Valley. Can you talk about why you've chosen to prioritize that, speak up on a lot of those issues?
There is a young man who I met with a couple months ago now, actually. He is undocumented. He takes care of his brothers and sisters. He gets up in the morning and goes and works in the fields. He goes to school in the afternoon, and then he works another job at night. And before he leaves in the morning, he tells his brothers and sisters, don't be afraid if I don't come home. Because he's afraid of getting picked up and maybe being deported, and his brothers and sisters wouldn't know where he is. It's fighting for, you know, the people that are actually contributing to our economy and to our communities that deserve to be recognized for those contributions. You know, more so, we know that anybody here in the U.S., I think we all agree, should be here legally on one hand. And the other hand, and I've said it before, you know, you talk to any farmer, any business, and they'll tell you, you know, we've got a real problem with immigration or with immigrants. We don't have enough of them, right? And what we're talking about naturally are legal immigrants, and so we need to have that system that's going to allow us to meet our workforce needs. It's not going to separate families. It's going to provide certainty in the future, and certainly a program that's not going to end up with kids being put in cages.
I cannot get out of here without asking a 2020 election question. I know David Valadao has announced that he wants to run again for this seat, and I don't know, what went through your head when you heard that?
It's a great opportunity. It's a great opportunity to illustrate what we've been doing about the Republican farmer who said, you know, TJ, I gotta tell you, I didn't vote for you, but I think you're doing a good job. About the young woman who I described earlier who said, I finally feel like there's somebody that cares about me It's about this young man who's getting up and working hard every day. I want to make a positive difference in his life. And so we continue to work hard. And as I said earlier to the crowd, I'm here to work for you. I work for you and my entire team in D.C. and here in the district. We all have that same mission. We work for the people of the 21st Congressional District.
And now that it's August recess and you're not constantly flying back and forth to the Beltway, do you have what's in store for this month for you?
Did you say recess? Is that we're certainly here in the district, and it's so nice to be back home and really be able to spend time and more, I want to say, quality time, like we're having this morning. A couple hours. I was at a VFW breakfast this morning. I was able to spend time with a lot of veterans. Thank you so much for all they did and have done. Spend time with all the people that came today, and I think there's maybe 100 people here, right? It was packed, as you saw. And really to once again, to listen to what people are concerned about, their issues. It's great to be out in the community and talk to the people that I represent.
Awesome. Well, Congressman T.J. Cox, thank you so much for taking the time on your not-quite-recess time in August.
It's always a pleasure.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. One of the biggest fears in any earthquake is that it could damage major infrastructure, and the recent Ridgecrest earthquakes jolted less than 50 miles away from Lake Isabella. That's where the Isabella Dam is in the midst of a $600 million improvement project by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Here to get an update on the project is FM89's Carrie Klein, who sat down with project manager Anthony Burdock.
In 2005, the Corps of Engineers does annual and regular checkups on their dams. We discovered that Isabella has three potential failure mechanisms: overtopping, seismic issues, and seepage. As part of that project, we designed mitigation measures to fix those issues. And this project, now we're under construction, is to reduce the flood risk for the people of Bakersfield.
And so tell me more about, you know, what could actually happen? What's at stake with each of those three measures that you talked about?
Well, ultimately, and these are in very extremely rare circumstances, we could have an event, whether it be an earthquake or a flood, that could cause the dam essentially to fail. These are extremely rare probabilities of something that's happening. But for the Corps of Engineers, our primary mission is public safety, and that's something we're really concerned about. So as part of our program, we just analyzed this and found the risk is too high for the downstream communities, so we needed to work to fix the areas where there's problems.
Yeah, I mean, if we talk specifically about overtopping, to start off with that one, you know, we've had a couple of particularly wet winters in the last couple of years. I mean, has there been a risk of overtopping with all of that?
No, there hasn't. Our overtopping threat is when we get these atmospheric river events that can come 3-4 days in the valley and essentially would fill up the entire dam and overtop it. What we're concerned about is the 1-in-9,000-year event. These are extremely rare. The last couple winters, 2016, 2017 in specific, I think was about a 50-year event, a 1-in-2% chance of happening in any single year. We are talking about very extreme events. These are not very likely to happen, probably never will happen, but it is possible. So the Corps of Engineers wants to make sure that our facilities can withstand any event that happens.
So what's involved in the project?
Well, this project is multiple features. We're primarily raising the dam 16 feet. We're adding a new emergency spillway, so in the event we get a large storm, that we will be able to pass the water through it. We're strengthening the dam. When we're raising, we're also widening it and adding new filter material in there so we can pass water safely, and then a rock face to stabilize that dam.
And then the entire project cost is around $600 million, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And so where are we at this point? How far along?
Well, we're very far. We've completed the design, and we issued a contract and started construction in January of last year. So we're expecting to finish up the major aspects of construction in 2021. We're going to have a few finishing things we're going to have to do, but I don't think the public's actually going to notice any of those. So we hope to be have the dam complete and a full lake again come 2022.
And so, you know, I think one of the buzzwords you said immediately was earthquakes, you know, bringing this up to kind of seismic code. So, of course, we just had a couple of really big earthquakes, not quite, you know, in the Lake Isabel area, but not all that far from it, over 4th of July weekend. So did those events impact the dam at all or this ongoing construction?
Well, they were considerable ways away, 40, 50 miles, but we have standard operating procedures when we get certain magnitude earthquakes with any distance to the facilities, we will go and do an inspection. We did that. We didn't see any issues with the dam. The project we're working on is specifically to mitigate a fault that actually runs underneath the auxiliary dam. When it was designed and built in the 40s and 50s, we thought this fault was inactive. Later, we discovered it is. So the Ridgecrest...
It is active, you mean?
Yes, the fault is active. Again, that's like their flood event. It's an extremely low probability of ever occurring, but we want to be able to be prepared in case that does. And while the Ridgequake earthquakes were... They were pretty big earthquakes. There wasn't any noticeable damage to Isabella.
So how do you even go and inspect for damage like that?
Well, our procedure is our operations folks immediately arrived at the dam, as well as our construction personnel and our contractor staff, and they looked over all the facility, checked for cracking in any concrete features. They checked the earthen dam to make sure there was any soil movement, any rocks came down. We have multiple instruments on the dam. We check those to see if there was anything noticeable on them. We check wells to make sure there's no material in the water coming through the dam, and there was no problems at all. We have some seismic instruments at the dam, both just normally and as part of the construction, and while those did pick up movement, it was minimal.
And so, as I said earlier, the dam was built in the 50s. We know more about seismic activity now than we did then. You know, is this project going to bring it up to earthquake code or seismic code here in the state of California?
Well, and you're completely right. We did design this in the 40s. It was finished construction in 1953. And our knowledge of meteorology, geology has increased considerably since then. The dam was built to their modern standards at that time. But our obviously standards have increased now, and we are bringing it up to modern standards. The Corps of Engineers has their own internal guidelines, which we use, and we're designing to those guidelines. So,
as you said, there's an active fault, mm-hmm. Or somewhat active fault that runs underneath one of the mm-hmm. dams here. Is there? I mean, should activity pick back up on that, and there be movement along the fault? Is there any way to really protect against that?
Well, that's what we're actually designing for. If the fault is active, we believe that the maximum earthquake you get is a 7.5 magnitude earthquake, and you get lateral displacement of the dam up to 7 feet. That would be a considerable event. Our design is working to mitigate an earthquake of that event. We are designing actually where the dam could move laterally up to, the fault could move laterally up to 14 feet.
And the dam would still survive.
Yes, the dam would survive. A good analogy is if you get into a car crash, there might be damage, airbags might go off, but you would be safe. If that magnitude event occurred, we would obviously have to go and do a good deal of work at the dam, but it would not fail, and the communities downstream would be safe.
Okay, very interesting. Well, so what year will this project all be done according to, if everything goes according to plan?
Well, we hope to have most of the features done by 2022. We design the dam, and then we build it, but we just don't take what we build. We have outside reviewers, both from the Corps, other parts of the Corps of Engineers, as well as outside experts, that they're going to come in and review. They've reviewed the design, that it accomplished what we set out to accomplish. They're also going to come in at the end of construction and check, did we build what we set out to build, and did that actually solve the problems we're hoping to mitigate? So, like anything else, the dam will be complete, but we will be doing testing after the fact. That won't be noticeable to the public. We'll have to wait to the reservoir to fill the back the dam up, the lake up again, and then we can do several other tests. But 2022, we have hope to have most of the construction completed.
Fabulous. Well, Anthony Burdock is a project manager with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in charge of the safety modifications at Isabella Dam. Anthony, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
The hills are alive with the sound of music, with songs they have sung for a thousand years.
And now it's time for the weekend. Wonder what that sound is? Well, we're taking you on an armchair listening tour of Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks. We're up at 11,896 feet right now. Close your eyes and imagine a herd of Sierra bighorn sheep running on a rocky path. And now, you can probably guess, two males butting heads to establish dominance. These clashes can last for hours. They end when one of the males concedes. And here's a sound you might recognize, coyotes. They communicate by howling to call the pack together or warn of their presence to other packs. 265 sounds have been recorded in the park, and they are now accessible to the public on the National Parks website. That's a Sierran tree frog, by the way. It's called the Soundscape Library, and it offers interactive maps, photos, and information, along with recorded sound from the foothills all the way up to the alpine peaks. Here's the sound of black bears ripping apart a log to find insects, and black bears running. And here's the wind in Redwood Canyon. Scientists use specialized equipment to record soundscapes. Sounds can be useful in determining all kinds of information. For instance, how does wildfire affect the diversity of birds in giant sequoia forest? Or how do the numbers and types of species change in an area over seasons or years? And if you decide this weekend instead to get out of the house and head up to the parks, there's also a soundscape library in the Kings Canyon Visitor Center at Grant Grove. That's the birdsong of the black-headed grosbeak recorded at 6,500 feet. So stay at home or get out and enjoy the trees. Either way, take some time to listen to the forest. And to cool you off on this summer day, we're going to end with the sound of rain.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook.
Don't forget to check out our app. It's called KVPR, and it's available for free on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by the KVPR news team. Laura Satsui and Carrie Klein.
Monica Velez and Alice Daniel. Technical support from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm Laura Satsui.
And I'm Alice Daniel. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need. On the web at chcf.org.